Well, hello, good morning, it's Abbey 104. It's 11:05 on Sunday morning. And it's Folk Tales with me, Terry Bennett. And in the studio this morning, I have Mark Woodhouse. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, Terry.
And Mark, you are the chairman of Holden Woodhouse, the brewery.
Yes, for my sins, yeah. Which are considerable, I think.
And this is not a new business by any means, is it? It goes back quite a while.
It does, yeah. We're sort of in our 241st year. So my great-great-great-great-grandfather, Charles Hall, founded the business out at Anstey back in 1777. And we've been sort of hopefully growing ever since. Moved to Blandford in sort of mid-1800s. Built a new brewery in 1900. And we've just built another new brewery 5 years ago, actually, on the Blandford site. So we haven't moved very far, about 8 miles.
But it's a thriving business, isn't it? And you employ how many?
Well, directly, about 1,500 people, and probably indirectly through our business partnership pubs, another 1,500 people. So,
and there's 200 pubs, I believe, isn't
it? Yeah, we've got just under 200 pubs now, yeah.
So it's grown from not a lot to that in a couple hundred years, so it's been going a while.
Yeah, but it started off in sort of, as I say, 1777, and Charles Hall was a farmer. Yeah. And he wanted to know what to do with his surplus grain, and he thought, I know what I'll do, I'll make beer. And he built a very large brewery for the time. And actually, that brewery, part of that brewery, is still standing. It's Anstey Village Hall. And that was the sort of part of the maltings in the building there. And they started buying pubs in about 1850. And by 1900, they had bought 100 pubs. So they traded well, and particularly with the troops who were based at Weymouth during the Napoleonic Wars, made good money, obviously, and reinvested. You know, it's something that we've done ever since.
Ever since, okay. And your involvement with the company dates back not quite that long.
Not quite that long, 1979.
But a reasonable period of time.
Yes, yeah. If you look at our Roll of Honour board in the brewery, 25 years is bagatelle, but yes. 40 is the serious one. That's which comes up
the
in
gold
18
watch
months.
Territory, yeah.
Yes.
And Mark, we're going to wander through your life a little and come up to date with that. But before we do, perhaps we should have your first record, and that's a bit of Bob Dylan. Why have you chosen this?
Well, because my wife's not a great Bob Dylan fan, and I thought I could get away with this one in your company because there's nothing she could do about it. But Bob Dylan was a great, you know, when I was at school, Bob Dylan was the you know, singer-songwriter.
I see. Okay, well, it's Bob Dylan, I Want You.
Guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn, but it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you. I want you, I want you, I want you so bad. Honey, I want you. Drunken politician leaps upon the street where mothers weep, and the saviors who are fast asleep, they wait for you. And I wait for them to interrupt me drinking from my broken cup and ask me to open up the gate for you. I want you, I want you, yes, I want you so bad. They've gone down, true love, they've been without it. But all their daughters put me down, cause I don't think about it. Well, I return to the Queen of Spades and talk with my chambermaid. She knows it, she's not afraid to look at her. because you lied, and because he took you for a ride, and because time is on his side, and because I want you, I want you, yes, I want you so bad.
That's Bob Dylan, and I Want You from 1966, as chosen by my guest in the studio today, Mark Woodhouse, who's the chairman of Hall & Woodhouse, the Brewers. And Mark, we were just mentioning a minute ago the current state of play with the brewery, and we'll come back to that as the discussion unfolds. But let's go back a bit. You are a fairly local lad, actually, aren't you?
Yeah, born and brought up in Blandford, Dorset, as they say, Dorset born, Dorset bred, strong in the arm and thick in the head.
Not heard that one before. And the family is obviously mixed up very much in the business, isn't it?
Yeah.
So father was part of Hall & Woodhouse.
Yeah, my father and his elder brother, Edward, they were joint managing directors, and my father was head brewer. They left school during the Second World War, and my father and my uncle both did war service. And then, you know, literally after that, my father, when he was demobbed, he then learnt to brew and went to Friary Mew Brewery up in Guildford. My uncle played cricket for Somerset for two seasons and captained Somerset. So they had a couple of years, I think, probably enjoying themselves. And then my great uncle Frank said, get back in the business, do some work. So they ran the business for a considerable period, you know, from the 1950s up until the mid-80s.
Okay. Tell us about your early life, though. You were born, as you say, in Blandford, and presumably went to school somewhere fairly local, did you?
Yes, I went to a place called Sandroyd, which is up near Tollard Royal, and then went on to Marlborough. Okay. And in between, in the holiday time, I used to go and work in the brewery, which was great fun.
I see. And
I remember as the junior person having to go and collect 3 pints of mild, you know, for the guys who worked in the racking cellar, because we still had a daily allowance of 3 pints. And as the junior, you had to go and get the seniors their beer. But it always earned me some pocket money, and that was great fun. Yeah. And you know, we lived next door to the brewery, and it just seemed the obvious thing to do. So I've sort of grown up with the brewery all my life, really.
Tell me about school.
We'll gloss over that, I'm afraid. I was the victim of a misspent youth. I didn't particularly enjoy my time at Sandroyd. And Marlborough, by contrast, was very libertarian. And as a consequence, I didn't do any work at all, you know. Right.
Were able to get away with that?
Well, if you call, you know, 5-0 levels just, you know, scraped, you know, as getting away with it, I suppose. I pity the young generation nowadays. They couldn't get away with that.
So you say Marlborough was fairly easygoing in those days, but I mean, it's got a great name now, hasn't it?
It was very easygoing, but I think it relied on your own self-discipline, you know, to ensure that you did what you had to do. And my self-discipline was distinctly lacking.
Why was that? Were you just not interested in academia at all?
I didn't really see much point in that. You know, there were better things to be doing. Marlborough had just gone co-educational. You know, I was discovering beer and things like that. Right. There were plenty of distractions. So
it wasn't a particularly enjoyable time of life.
It was fun, yeah. It was great fun. I spent a lot of time in the carpentry shop at Marlborough, which was great fun. Usually playing chicken with chisels with my mate Kirkland Tarwright, and I've still got some scars to prove that I wasn't very good at that either.
Okay, so I'm guessing then on the back of that, university wasn't always going to be an option then?
Well, it was quite interesting because my uncle, who was chairman of the company at the time, had been in and obviously been in the services, and had, was also a Cambridge scholar. So, and at the time, the army were dead short of people. So they used to say, you know, short service in the army, short service commission in the army, that's equivalent to 3 years at university. And I used to show this to him, and of course, he knew bloody well it wasn't. But so university definitely wasn't out. And I thought, well, rather than do what my father wanted, which was to go straight from school to the brewery, I thought what I would do is to buy myself a little time and join the army for 3 years.
That, with what in mind? You wanted to escape the preordained career path that you were
absolutely
going to have.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Just seemed, I obviously always wanted to come into the brewery. And I did 3 years, and I remember being asked by somebody in the army, you know, would I like to sign on? And I thought, ooh, somebody wants me. This is interesting. And I wrote to my uncle, who's, as I say, the chairman at the time, and I said, you know, I've been asked to sign on. What do you think? And I got this lovely letter back saying, marvellous news. Sign on for as long as you like. So I thought, I'll do one more year, and then I better get back to Blandford.
Okay, so the military life beckoned then. So what did that amount to? How did you get on there?
Yeah, it was good fun. I enjoyed that, actually. I enjoyed that. We went to Catterick, which was pretty bleak. And remember doing a lot of running, a lot of physical exercise. You know, we did the Like Weight Walk, which is about 26 miles across the Yorkshire Moors. And we also canoed up the Caledonian Canal in midwinter. That was a bit of a challenge. Yes, it was a bit bleak and cold. Yeah. But yeah, army life was good, you know. And then having done that, I went to Sandhurst and did 6 months there. Made some good friends there, still got them, you know, and that was another challenge.
Tell me about Sandhurst.
Sandhurst is like everywhere else, it's a game, you know. Right. Okay. You have to play it by their rules, and you know, we worked that out, but we kicked against it quite fairly, you know. It was good fun. We had a really good time as well as working bloody hard, you know, and we burnt the candle at both ends. I seem to remember falling asleep coming down the M3 in my car at about 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. Having been clubbing in London, and then we would then get on parade at 6 o'clock, right, and off right. We went again.
So some of these fly-on-the-wall documentaries you see about life in Sandhurst aren't too far from reality.
Yes, possibly, yeah. I don't think they get away with now what they
Quite
we
as much.
Used to.
I see. So that was an enjoyable experience.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I then had 3 very happy years out in Germany in a place called Paderborn with my regiment. You know, we had a great time out there. Yeah. And, again, they pretty much let me do what I wanted, which was to get involved in horses, and I looked after we had 2 or 3 race horses, and it was my job to look after them, so that was my duty. So I was excused first parade, you know, providing I went riding out instead. So,
well, the horse theme will develop a little as we go on, but is that the very early interest? Was that right from childhood?
Well, horses were always part of our home, you know. I mean, we always had ponies as kids. We were very lucky. My parents both rode. My mother race rode in point to points. You know, so the horses were always around, you know. Yeah. It seemed quite a natural thing to be doing, you know. Yeah. Just a natural part of life.
I suppose we
life.
Should probably drop in here that you got married in the middle of all this, didn't you?
Yes, I did. When I left the army, yes. Yeah. I married Tessa, who you had on your show.
She was here
last, summer,
last year. She was indeed, yes. And she, of course, is very much immersed in the horse world. Isn't she?
Yeah,
riding for the disabled. And she was a point-to-point jockey herself, wasn't she?
She was. She rode a lot more than me. Mm. And she actually beat me in one race, which was quite character forming, particularly as I thought I was going to win the race, and I ended up last. but no, she rode well, you know.
Did you meet through horse connections? Was that
sort of, yes, yeah. Yes, my cousin, I think, introduced us, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah. Okay, shall we take your second record, because we're sort of moving on to what happened post army, aren't we? And so let's have a look. You've got some Leonard Cohen now.
Oh yes, this is probably another one that's from school days, you know. But the great Canadian poet, alack, alas, no longer with us.
Okay, well, it's Leonard Cohen, and the track is So Long, Marianne.
Come over to the window, my little darling. I'd like to try to read your poem. I used to think I was some kind of gypsy boy before I let you take me home. Now so long, Marianne, it's time we began to lie and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. Well, you know that I love to live with you, but you make me forget so very much. I forget to pray for the angels, and then the angels forget to pray for us. Ah, so long, Marianne, it's time that we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again. We met when we were almost young, deep in the green lilac. Held on to me like I was a crucifix, as we went kneeling through the dark. Oh, so long, Marianne, time we began to laugh and cry and cry and laugh about it all again.
Your letter. That's Leonard Cohen and So Long, Marianne. And that was from 1967. He, of course, was a Canadian poet and musician. And it featured on his debut album, Songs of Leonard Cohen. And you were just saying, Mark, that Marianne was a significant other in his life.
I think so, yeah. Apparently, he sent a message to her before she died, you know. And he didn't die. He died not long after, I think.
Right, okay. We're talking to Mark Woodhouse, who's the chairman of Hall & Woodhouse, the brewery company of long, long standing. We've reflected the fact they've been around for more than 200 years, considerably more than 200 years. But, Mark, we got to the point where you were in the army. You'd been to Sandhurst. You were serving with the Queen's Royal Irish Hussars, wasn't it?
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
And then you actually ended up in Ireland at some point, didn't you?
Yes. I did 6 months tour in Lisbon, which was as a watchkeeper, you know, so you monitored what was going on throughout the whole of the Northern Ireland, which was, you know, very interesting. Fortunately, it was a pretty quiet year when I was there. You know, there wasn't much terrorist activity, you know. And, you know,
this was the late 70s, wasn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, prior to it had been pretty grim.
Yeah, sure.
And it's just delightful that, you know, you can see relative peace today.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, but the time came when you decided to leave the army. What prompted you to do that?
Well, as I say, I thought I'd probably do my extra year, and then I thought I'd better get back to the business and start. And it was quite a sort of, I thought, well, if I'm going to change my life, you know, then I'll change it all. So I got married, left the army, joined the business all in one fell swoop.
Okay.
So 1979 was a very significant year for me.
And so you come into the business with a modest amount of knowledge of the trade, as it were, from the family.
Yeah.
But no hands-on experience other than what you were doing at school.
Yeah. As a family member, you know, you get a buy into the first round.
Sure.
You know,
You don't have to fill in an application form.
No, they said, come and work for us for 6 months, you know. And it was a case of, you can look at us and we'll look at you. And then the next stage is, you know, okay, so we don't think you're a complete disaster. Maybe you'd like to do some more training and then we might offer you a job. But ultimately, you have to be able to get to the board. Otherwise, there was no future for you as a family member.
Sure.
You know, it's quite tough rules.
Yeah.
But that's why, you know, successful family businesses succeed, you know, is they don't have issues with succession.
So there was no sense of, well, you've got the family name, so you're automatically going to be a senior member of staff quite quickly. You had to work your way through.
Not if my uncle had anything to do with it. So I started out life, I was what they call a pupil brewer. And this is where you went away to learn how to the rudiments of brewing at other people's breweries, you know. And so we all swapped pupils, and you got an idea as to how beer was made. So I spent 2.5 years. I was in Manchester for 10 months, which was quite interesting. You know, Manchester was at a really sort of quite a buzzy point at that stage. You know, the newspapers were still printed up there. I don't know if they are today, but you know, it was a very cosmopolitan place. You know, it was a good fun place to be, and you know, the beer scene in Manchester was absolutely thriving. I don't think it's ever been as consumption has ever been as high as it was back then. You know, it was huge.
Yeah.
So that was really fascinating. I also spent some time in Bedford, where I learned quite a lot more about brewing. I think it's fair to say in Boddington's, it was a closed shop, you know, so in other words, you had to be a union member to be employed. Mm-hmm. So I didn't learn much about brewing, but I learned a lot about what they called labour relations in those days. There was always a strike just looming around the corner.
Which would go on to serve you in later days.
Yeah, exactly. And then at Bedford, I learned, you know, a lot more about brewing. It was, you know, quite a modern brewery, and they were lovely people there, and I had a great time. So, and as W.C. Fields said, if I had to live my life over again, I'd live over a pub. Well, I lived over a pub for 6 months.
There's worse ways of spending your life.
Yes.
So you eventually came back, presumably, to the family business.
Yeah.
What did you then do?
I came back and I was offered a job in sales. Okay. And I thought, right, this is my opportunity. You know, this is how I can sort of start to climb the greasy pole. And I made it quite my purpose, you know, to win every sales promotion that there ever was. I seem to remember there was one pub I sold a whole load of spirits to at Christmas, and I came round the following year. You know, they complained bitterly that they still had some of the spirits that I'd sold in the last Christmas, but I did win the promotion. So I also remember buying a record player or a stereo.
Oh, gosh.
Hi-fi.
Yes, yes.
With some tokens that I got for being the top salesman. And my wife said the other day, she said, I want to throw this out. I said, you can't. Ooh. That is a significance, you know. It's that I earned that, so you can't get rid of it. So sales was really my route into the business. And I eventually sort of went through the sales side of things and became a sort of senior salesman, and then a area manager, and then I headed up the whole of the sales side on the pub side.
Tell us about the business as it was then, because it's obviously evolved. This would be the early 80s, presumably, you're talking about now, is it?
Yes, and into the 90s, yeah.
Okay. So we're talking, you know, better part of 35 years back.
Yeah. The
brewing business, I guess, has changed in that period of time, and consumer base and consumer preferences has changed in that period of time as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Terry. I mean, when I joined in 79, beer was very much a commodity. We brewed two beers, Boy's Bitter or Badger Bitter, 3% alcohol, Best Bitter, 4% alcohol. And we did a couple of bottle beers and a barley wine, but that was it. And, you know, back in the sort of 70s and prior to that, you know, workers who'd been doing manual work would have lost a lot of liquid during the day. And the idea was that, you know, you came back, you had your tea, and then you went down the pub and you had sort of 5 or 6 pints yes. of boys' bitter.
Yeah.
And, of course, you could feel very fine after that because it was pretty close to water.
Sure.
And then go to work the next day. And then on Friday night, of course, you drank best bitter.
Right.
So, you know, beer was very much a commodity. And, you know, how that's changed is that, you know, now we're drinking a lot less of more. So we're drinking less volume but stronger, you know, slightly stronger beers. So the average beer now would be, say, between 4 and 5% alcohol, whereas in those days it was between, you know, 3 and 4% alcohol. I think the other big social change is that how people drink their beer and well, all alcohol, really. In the 70s, 80% of all alcohol was drunk in the pub or on premise, you know, so pubs and clubs. Now it's sort of slightly less than 50-50. You know, there's more beer and alcohol being drunk at home. So it's been a massive social change over a comparatively short period of time.
We alluded a few minutes ago to the fact that you've got a pub estate of about 200 now. What was the situation back then? Did you have tied pubs in the same way that you do now? It was pretty similar.
Yeah.
What numbers wise was it greater?
The sort of number wise numbers have ebbed and flowed a bit.
Yeah.
We were at about 180 when I joined the business. Okay.
Not a lot different.
Then we acquired a business over in Sussex called King and Barnes, and that we took on 55 more pubs there. And so that took us up. We were nearly up to 250 by that stage. But, you know, the pubs have changed as well. You know, the smaller ones have just faded. You know, as I say, as the social change has bitten, you know, lots of small pubs, particularly in North Dorset. I mean, we used to have, I think, something like 80 pubs in Dorset, you know. Well, and in North Dorset, I think we've got 15% of the pubs that we owned 40 years ago. So,
right.
you know,
right.
the social change has had quite big implications for the rural areas. I think Marnell, we used to have 6 pubs, for example. Now we've got 1. But one pub that's thriving.
Sure.
And, you know, that's the way that progress it goes. Of our 190 pubs now, I would say they're a lot bigger. So whilst the number hasn't changed, you know, the actual turnover that they generate, you know, would be vastly different.
And so, presumably a lot more of is food related now, is it?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I mean, food can you know amount to anything up to 60% of a pub's turnover. And it's probably fair to say that, you know, when a pub shuts, it's doing less than £5,000 a week in turnover, which is not sustainable.
Mm.
But when a pub opens, it's doing £25,000 a week, you know, and it just sort of demonstrates the difference, you know, in the pubs of yesteryear and the pubs of today. You know, you've got to have the economies of scale. It's like pretty much everything else, you know, in life. In a competitive world, you need that edge which comes with size.
Sure. Getting back to your career path, you were a salesman, effectively, for a number of years and then worked your way up and became sales director, I believe.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I remember...
that was a seat on the board then, was it?
Yes, it was, yeah. But as I remember, you know, my sales days with great... you know, I loved that. It was good fun. And I remember one of the things I used to do on a Friday, of course, was Roy Promley's Desert Island Discs.
Oh,
you know,
gosh. So I've heard of that program.
Yeah, yeah. I haven't made, you know, Desert Island Discs, but I have made Folk Tales. So thank you for that.
And we should perhaps tell the listeners that you were complaining bitterly earlier that on Desert Island Discs it's only a 45-minute program, but you get 8 records. This one's an hour and you only get 5.
Life's tough.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, there we go.
So I graduated from salesman to sales director and got my seat on the board.
That then was less going out and more supervision, wasn't
no,
it?
No, more going out.
More going out,
more
right.
going out mm-hmm. yeah, more going out. It all happens in the trade, you know. I mean, even now I spend most of my time in the pubs. So, you know, the business doesn't happen in Blandford, you know, in an office. It happens around the pubs.
Okay. And the sales director role, how long did that sustain you?
Oh, quite a bit of time, I think, yes. And then I sort of moved over to sort of corporate side of things, helping my cousin David, my late cousin David. And that was another role. And then, unfortunately, when he died in 2009, then I had to go back into management with his brother, Anthony Woodhouse, and we were managing directors for a year. And then he became managing director and I became chairman. So.
Okay. And tell me about the chairman role as opposed to the managing director role. The chairman, what's the subtlety between the two?
Oh, there is a huge subtlety. With the chairman, you take all the glory and do none of the work.
Whereas the managing director gets none of the glory and does all of the work.
Correct. You got it in one.
So tell me about what's an average sort of day in your life. You spend most of it in the pub, you were saying.
Yes, it's not a bad old life, you know, and tasting beer. You know, I'm the chief beer taster. Pubs are all about people, you know, so we have teams. You run those pubs. And, you know, how they engage with our guests is absolutely vital. So we spend a lot of time going around doing training, teaching people in the pubs, you know, about beers, you know, and the history of the beers and our values, so that, you know, when guests come into the pubs, you know, they get terrific hospitality. So, as I say, there's a lot. You know, there's an awful lot to be done. As I think it was Lord Sainsbury said, you know, retail is all about detail. And that's what we spend our life doing, you know, making sure, you know, that the guest journey is as perfect as it possibly can be. From the moment, you know, you drive into the car park to the moment you drive out, you know, it should be, a make your day experience and should be the highlight of your day.
That's interesting because it's not all about the technicalities of making or brewing beer. It's about the customer experience and making sure that your people are able to deliver that and give you the edge over somebody down the road. It might not be quite so good.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I think it's quite interesting. I suspect that in, you know, on the high street at the moment, there's lots of sort of urban casual dining chains who are closing like fury. And I suspect the ones that are left on the high street, you know, are busy cutting their labour costs. Because they need to try and make ends meet, you know. And of course, what does that leave? You know, that leaves a pretty poor experience for the guest. You know, our view is that, you know, that's the time you need to up the hospitality. You know, when people are really searching for value, so that they can see what a fantastic job you know you're doing at making their day.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take your third track. This is Neil Diamond.
Oh, yes.
Song Blue.
When I was walking out, you know, up in London, I think this was the song of the moment, you know, and it sort of reminds me of the great times, you know, we had certainly with Tessa in London, and that was the start of the big romance. So, Song Blue, definitely.
Yeah, lovely.
Song sung blue, everybody knows one. Song sung blue, every garden grows one. Me and you are subject to the blues now and then. When you take the blues and make a song, you sing them out again. You sing them out again. Song sung blue, weeping like a willow. Song sung blue, sleeping on my pillow. Funny thing, but you can sing it with a cry in your voice. And before you know it, get to feeling good. You simply got no choice.
check too. The blues now and then. But when you take the blues and make a song, you sing them out again. Song sung blue, weeping like a willow. Song sung blue, sleeping on my pillow. Funny thing, but you can sing it with a cry in your voice. Start feeling good, you simply got no choice. Song sung blue. Song sung
There we are, Song Sung Blue by Neil Diamond from 1972, written and recorded by the same man, inspired by the second movement of Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 21. Now, did you know that, Mark?
No, nope. Definitely
well,
not.
Neither did I till I looked it up before the programme. But it's always good to drop these things in. As chosen by Mark Woodhouse, my guest in the studio today, chairman of Hall & Woodhouse. And Mark, we've got quite up to date, really, haven't we? You became chairman in 2009, and you're saying that that's a job that takes all the glory, and you don't have to do any of the work. But I'm guessing that's probably not quite true.
My wife would say it isn't true. Yeah, today, you know, we've got a, I think, in many respects, a very similar company to that which was founded by Charles Hall back in 1777. It's still very much a people-based business. And, of course, they realised that they needed an outlet for the brewery and they needed pubs, you know. And that's exactly the same as it is today. You know, so we built a new brewery in 2011. And that'll keep us going for another 100 years, and it'll keep a lot more pubs going too. And our aim in life now, you know, is to sort of build our pub estate, both what we call business partnerships, which would be the slightly smaller ones, whereby we have, we used to call them tenants, they're rather like sort of franchise operators, but business partner describes the relationship that we have with them. So smaller pubs that are very good, you know, reliable, steady, like the White Hart in Sherburn here. Mm-hmm. And then we've also got bigger pubs that we are building, and we've got a plan to open quite a few, you know, okay. Two or three a year. We opened the Duchess of Cornwall about 18 months ago in Poundbury.
Yes.
Yeah. A modest pub built by the Duchy of Cornwall.
It's huge.
Yes, it is. It is.
Very imposing at night as well, isn't it?
It is, and it is the only pub in the world with Doric, Ionic and Corinthian pillars.
Gosh. Right.
But I'm not sure the Duchy got them in the right order. that'll be another tale. But so that's a good example of how we see pubs going in the future. We just opened a pub down near Exeter, a new town called Cranbrook.
Cranbrook, yes.
7,500 new homes, 3 new schools, 1 new pub,
right.
The Cranberry
right.
Farm. Okay. And that's doing really well. And that's quite often, you know, that's going to be how we think the business will grow,
yeah.
Where we build these big pubs, you know, they're capable of turning over more than £25,000 net a week, which is a lot of money, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
You've got to sell a lot of pints and a lot of pies to get to £25,000. So they rely on sort of high densities of population.
Because the number of breweries over the years, I guess, has shrunk somewhat, hasn't it?
It's been it's ebbed and flowed. Number of breweries, I think, post Second World War was about 200, and that shrank down to some 35 to 40 in the early 80s, of which 30 were independent family brewers such as ourselves. And what's happened since Gordon Brown relaxed the duty scheme to encourage small brewers is that we've now got 2,000 breweries.
Gosh, right.
So, as I say, it has ebbed and flowed. You know,
a lot of them must be tiny.
Yes, they are. Mm. But history, you know, has repeated itself, because all breweries were small. You know, we were small at one stage.
Sure.
And I think, you know, it's marvellous that there's so much excitement around beer at the moment. You've only got to look in the supermarket shelves. You can see lots of craft beers and lots of ales on the shelf, which is great. If you're a beer drinker, there's never been a better time to be alive.
Tell me about the process, though. I mean, you think of 1777, somebody stood there with big oak vats and whatever it may be, and it's changed a lot since then. But has it? And I guess the basic process is the same. But.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The raw materials haven't changed. The science, brewing science and technology has changed out of all recognition, but the real process, you know, isn't that much different from what it was in 1777. As I say, the brewing science is moved on in leaps and bounds, but today our head brewer will sometimes shift awkwardly from one foot to another, and I say, come on, Toby, which is it, black art or science? When you're dealing with nature, you never quite rely on it to the last degree.
What are the challenges these days compared with when you first joined the business? What stops you from sort of moving on? Is it regulation or red tape?
We're in a very competitive environment. Mm. You know, there's no doubt about that. I mean, beer volumes have been declining since 1976. Yeah. So, you know, that's a challenge in its own right. You know, I mean, pubs are always having to reinvent themselves. The demise of the pub, you know, has been incorrectly forecast many times. And, you know, even today, they're reinventing themselves. Who would have thought you could get pizza in a pub? Mm. If you'd said that 40 years ago, or even fish and chips, you know, the people would have looked at you and said you're mad. So pubs have been great at reinventing themselves. And you know, the pub is a real cornerstone of the community. And it's quite interesting. We've seen this last sort of year or so now, actually people are going back to the pubs, not so much to eat as they used to, but to go back and drink and have a good time. And it's, you know, a convivial place.
So that trend is just beginning to change, isn't
it?
Slightly?
And the drink isn't always alcohol either. You know, I mean, you know, alcohol levels have gone down quite significantly over the last sort of 20 years. We're drinking less alcohol. But, you know, people just want to go and meet and chat, you know, and the pub provides that lovely opportunity. You know, we're a gregarious nation. We love, you know, to get together and moan about the weather or the politicians or anything you care to name.
And the changing prevalence towards home drinking, you've had to obviously meet that challenge as well. Has that been a difficulty, or is it? It's obviously affected the numbers going to pubs.
Yes, it has. You know, but then we thought, okay, well, what do we do about that? You know, are we going to play in the supermarkets? And the answer was yes. I remember Tesco's produced a challenge about 20 years ago, which was to come up with a summer beer. And that's where we came up with our first flavoured ale, which was Golden Champion Ale, which has got a bit of elderflower in it. Mm-hmm. And 20 years on, that's still selling really well.
Okay. Shall we take your penultimate track? Because time is marching on. And then we'll come back and talk a little bit about you and what you do to relax outside your many responsibilities in Holland Woodhouse. This is Peter Skellen, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. He used to come down and play at the Grosvenor, I think. You know, I never seemed to have quite the funds to be able to go and have dinner at the Grosvenor to listen to him play.
Anyway, it's Peter Skellen and it's Hold On To Love.
Life, there's one.
That's Peter Skellen, Hold On to Love, from 1975, got to number 14 in October. In that year, I don't know what month. He was ordained as a minister, actually, shortly before his death, which I hadn't realised, but there you go. Anyway, in the studio, it's Mark Woodhouse, chairman of Hall and Woodhouse. And Mark, we've got really, really up to date now, haven't we? And we talked about the business that it now is and the challenges and your aspirations for the company as it moves forward. But let's just reflect on a couple of other things. The company's got quite a charitable involvement as well, hasn't it?
Yeah, we ran the community chests. We started up in 2002, and that's just for local voluntary organisations to apply for a pool of funds. And we put up £50,000 this year for those organisations to apply for. And we never cease to be amazed by the great works that local voluntary organisations do in their community. Here in Sherburn, the West End Club applied for some money. I think they wanted some new tables, that sort of thing. So, you know, we help with the small things. But small amounts of money can go a long, long way in the hands, you know. So we feel really privileged to be part of that. And it's been running, as I say, since 2002, and we've given over £500,000 to
it. That's great, yeah. So if any organisations are listening that want to get in contact with you, that's on the website, isn't it?
Good plug. Yes, go to the website, Hall & Woodhouse, All About Us, and then click on Community Chest. It's open now till the 4th of May. Yeah, so.
Okay. And another way that people can get involved, if they are interested, is they can come on one of your tours, couldn't they?
Yes. The Brewery Tap, home to the Great Badger Ales, is where the worshippers come right. And pay homage. And, of course, the temple is the brew house. And we invite, you know, lots of people to come, you know, and we do brewery tours on a daily basis, so...
You know, I have to say, 11 o'clock. I went around a brewery, one of your competitors, not that long ago. It was very fascinating. It was too.
So, breweries are lovely places. Yes.
And we should also say that you are the master of the Worshipful Company of Brewers. What does that mean?
Well, this is the livery company in London, and it was my privilege to be the master of the Worshipful Company of Brewers in 2012, so the Olympic year, which was great fun. And apart from eating and drinking a lot, you do about two or three dinners and lunches a week, we look after a big charity which looks after education in Islington. So livery companies, you know, renowned for their charitable works. Mm. But also the Brewers Company is unlike most other livery companies, is a very much a closed shop. To be a brewer, you have to be a brewer. So you have to be a director of a brewery company. And so it's a great trade talking shop for us as well. Mm. So... It kills two birds with one stone.
And outside of your brewery interests, you are still a keen horseman, aren't you?
Yes, I've moved on from riding them to owning them. Yeah, we've got our shares in a couple of racehorses, which is keeps us in work because they're quite expensive to run.
Yeah, I'm sure they are. And you're involved with Tessa's Riding for the Disabled, which is a great organisation, which we talked about when she came on the programme.
Well, that happens at our house now, so I feel I've got a bit of skin in the game. So I have to get out there and harrow the school and do other various jobs. And in the snow, I was shovelling quite a bit of pony poo, so quite glad when it all went.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is sailing. You've been a sailor for quite a number of years.
Yes, I've always had a boat of one description or another. I think I bought my first boat at age 17 with the proceeds of my holiday brewery work, you know. And we've got a small boat called an X boat, which we sail in Poole Harbour and race, you know, a couple of times a week, which is great fun in the summer.
Yeah. Mark, we're coming towards the end of the time that we have available to us, and we're going to go out with your final piece, which is the Planet Suite by Gustav Holst. Why this?
It's Jupiter, and it's the bringer of jollity. You know, my life has been a really jolly affair. You know, I've had a very privileged time. A life working in the brewing industry is always good fun. And, you know, my private life, I've had a great time, you know, nearly 40 years married to Tessa, and that's been fabulous. And also, you know, everything else I seem to have been involved with has been good fun. If it's not good fun, it's not worth doing.
Right, okay. And this, of course, has the famous I vow to thee my country melody in the middle of it, doesn't it, the Jupiter?
Yes, I often think that should be I vow to thee my company, you know. So I vow to thee, Hall and Woodhouse, you know. I'll keep serving you till the end of my days.
Yeah. Quite right. Mark, thank you very much for coming in. It's been fascinating to talk to you, and we wish you well, and we wish the company well.
Thank you very much, Derek. It's been a privilege.